welcome.
Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernovsky, and this show is for Shabbat Parshat Chukat. That's Chukat in Israel. It happens to be the week of Parshat Korach in Chutz La'aretz, but the show will focus on Parshat Chukat. So Chutz La'aretz people are welcome to go to last week's archived file if they want to listen to something about Korach, or to stay with this show for Parshat Chukat. We've got one more week of this out-of-sync Parshat HaShavua. Next week is a different story. We in Israel will be reading Parshat Balak, and in Chutz La'aretz they will combine Chukat and Balak so that we will once again be up to each other. The following Shabbat, Yirtzeh Hashem, will be Shabbat Parshat Pinchas all over the world. Over the last number of weeks, I've been playing with a new opening to the show. For those who recognize it or don't, it's from Radio Mystery Theater, CBS Radio Mystery Theater, which in the New York area was broadcast on WOR 710. And I found an internet site that was selling the whole collection of Radio Mystery Theater on four CDs. Over 1,300 episodes, and I enjoy downloading them a few at a time into my MP3 player. And I decided to borrow the beginning with E.G. Marshall's voice, that creepy music they start with, and then they come in and welcome. And just as he's about to say, I'm E.G. Marshall, I put instead the other theme opener we've been using for many, many months, namely the music to Eitz Chaim Hi. And that brings us to this show. Before we begin, let us say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tehiyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmarya Adonai Mi'yamod. Ki Imecha Haslicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Ki Viti Adonai Kivata Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mishomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael, mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzarao v'ashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem, ויוציאים מצרה לרווחה ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב ונאמר אמן. Unfortunately, we've added to the list of who אחינו כל בית ישראל is and are, הנתונים בצרה ובשביה, who find themselves in troubles and in captivity. So our tefillot go to Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier who was kidnapped, and hopefully he will be returned to his family soon in good health and good condition. Happy to rejoin them and all of Klal Yisrael. Oh, Okay, let's take care of the basics. The beginning of Parshat Chukat is the portion of Para Aduma, the red heifer. It is a famous enigmatic mitzvah among other enigmatic mitzvot. It is known as the quintessential chok because of the language in the Torah, Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the chok, capital T-H-E, of the Torah. And then the command for Moshe to take a red cow and follow the procedure, which includes slaughtering the cow not in the Mikdash, the sanctuary, the temple area, but away from it in Yerushalayim. That was done on Har HaZeitim, across from the Temple Mount. After slaughter, there's a sprinkling of blood towards the place of the Mikdash. There's the burning of the cow completely, and into the burning goes a hyssop plant and a cedar branch, and the ashes are collected, a whole process. A potion is made with live spring water with additional ingredients, and that potion is that which allows a person who becomes ritually defiled to a dead body to become tahor, ritually pure again. Just to broaden the information and hopefully clarify, there are several different types of ritual impurity, tum'ah, which the Torah commands. Let's just broadly break them into three categories. There is the light version of Tuma, which is a one-day ritual impurity, which requires immersion in a mikveh, a ritualarium, a ritual bath, sometime during the day officially. And when night falls, meaning when the stars come out, the person is now tahor once again, a one-day minor tuma, with ramifications. Not going to go into all of that. Then there's the seven-day variety, which is the more serious type of tuma, which requires immersion in a mikveh on day seven. And when the seventh day is over and the stars come out on the eve of the eighth day, the person is tahor. However, this works for most of the seven-day tum'ah, not for tumat mate, which is the impurity from contact or being in the same room, under the same roof, as a dead body. That is a seven-day tum'ah, which not only requires mikveh, but also requires the application of the potion of the para aduma on the third day of impurity and on the seventh day. And only combination of 7 days, sprinkling on the third and the seventh, immersion in a mikveh, and nightfall following that period, does a person become tahor from that type of tuma. Now today, and for many, many, many years, unfortunately, we do not have the potion of the ashes of the Para Aduma. Therefore, we cannot rid ourselves of that level of ritual impurity. We still practice mikveh in certain cases. Not going to go into all of those details. But the essential tumat mate, which we consider everyone to have, cannot be rid of until the ritual of the Paraduma potion is reinstituted at some time in the future. A practical application of that fact is going to certain places on the Temple Mount today in our own time. For example, a person who is Temei Mate, which again I say we are all considered, is forbidden to go into the temple or its precincts or its courtyard or the area on which those, namely the Beit HaMikdash and its courtyard, stood. We consider, majority opinion will say, we consider the place of the Mikdash, even in its absence, to be holy, to be that level of holiness which the Torah forbids one who is Temei Mate from going there. Therefore, any place on the Temple Mount that the Beit HaMikdash stood, or might have stood, there are debates in archaeological circles and among scholars as to exactly where the temple stood, but any place on Har HaBayit that might have been the place of the Mikdash is off limits halachically to a Jew. No Jew, and I emphasize no Jew, is allowed there except for emergency security measures, which is the basis on which soldiers were able to capture it and patrol it, but that's a whole other issue. Trying to get back to the focus on Parshat Chukat and Paraduma. For another time, we'll discuss the details. There are parts of today's Temple Mount that definitely did not have that area, or let's say that are not part of that area where the Beit HaMikdash and its courtyard stood, and therefore a Temei Mate is allowed to go there. There are other types of ritual impurity that if a person has those, he's not allowed to go there, but the bottom line is that immersion in a mikveh can rid oneself of the objectionable tum'ah, ritual impurity, of the Har HaBayit, not where the temple stood, and allow someone to go there. This is a controversy. I really don't like to call it a halachic controversy. It is more of a political or politically correct or just in case or let's take precaution kind of prohibition. But I've said it before on the air and I'll say it again. A Jew is allowed onto certain parts of Har HaBayit, certain parts of the Temple Mount, with the preliminary precaution of ritual immersion and a few other restrictions, and it could be done today and should be done under proper rabbinical supervision of rabbis who have Temple Mount experience and are well versed in the various nuances of the halakha, as well as the geographic and topological reality of Har HaBayit. But I digress. So let's get back to Para Aduma as the quintessential chok. I would like to first of all, there is one other mitzvah in the Torah that is also introduced by Zot Chukat HaTorah. There are many other mitzvot which we consider to be chukim. A chok is generally defined as a mitzvah that defies logic, rationale, reasoning, easy understanding. It does not mean that we have no clue about these mitzvot. We definitely have insights into them, but there are details of the mitzvot which remain enigma and have stumped and puzzled scholars and wise people for generations, for centuries. Notwithstanding the above, it is fairly well known that Para Aduma is considered an atonement, a tikkun, a repair for the sin of the golden calf. Rashi brings an old analogy to a king who had a maid whose son dirtied the palace, and the king calls upon the mother to clean up after her son's mess. The son, in this case, is the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. And if you know different shades of gold, you know there's a pinkish-reddish kind of gold, which allows this analogy to work nicely. The Pora Aduma is not a red, rose-colored cow. It is a gingy, reddish hair, which is figuratively known as the mother of the Egel HaZahav, and she is called upon to atone for that sin. What always used to bother me about this notion, and in recent years I sort of worked out something in my own mind to help me understand it, and I would like to share that with you, is the fact that becoming ritually defiled to a dead body is not a sin. The potion of the Pora Aduma achieves ritual purity for that person and ostensibly has nothing to do with sin. Why then is it considered to be a kapara, an atonement, for the sin of the golden calf? Where there always seemed to me to be a gap in this otherwise neat analogy. If we were talking about a korban, an animal sacrifice of a female cow, or, as the case is, a bull, a male cow, where many of those korbanot are considered to be atonement for cheto egel, then it would sit better, because we associate korbanot with the process of kapara, atonement. But here, we're dealing with something that is a tuma and tahara, ritual impurity and purity issue, not a sin and repentance issue per se. Therefore, how do we connect these better? I would suggest the following, and especially because we're dealing with one type of ritual impurity, and that is corpse contact, and not other types of ritual impurity. And therefore, I would like to suggest the following. During a person's lifetime, he is a combination of a soul with his body. The soul is a chelek elokut, part of the essence of God, whatever that means, that is breathed in to a physical body for the duration of a person's lifetime. When a person dies, the soul is returned to the pool of souls, we'll say, and the body is buried in the ground. The soul, the neshama, is holy. The soul in a body is a living and breathing human being, and there is a holiness there too. When the soul departs and the body is left by itself, that holiness is missing, but it is not a given, automatically, that the body becomes what it actually is in Jewish law, the avi avot hatuma, the mother of all impurity, to coin the phrase more common in our time. A possible alternate scenario could have been that a dead body is the receptacle that held the soul when it is no longer possessing the soul, or in connection with the soul. The body is to be discarded in a respectful manner of burial, but it does not have to be considered the total opposite of sacred and sanctified. It could have been viewed as just an empty shell. Nothing that negative about the shell, nothing positive without the content. That's a possibility. It is the nature of sin, however, in general, specifically with a focus on the sin of the golden calf, that redefines or maybe I can't say redefines, but defines the status of a dead body by saying that the soul itself is pure, the body and soul have obligations to strive for holiness and to do mitzvot and to avoid sin. And when the body sins, it is the body that is held responsible and accountable. It failed the challenge that it had by virtue of the fact that it possessed a soul. And therefore, the body is given the status of avi avotatuma, a highest level of ritual impurity, to represent the disappointment that the body did not cooperate with its soul and follow God's laws, and therefore sin is represented by the ritual impurity that a dead body imparts to people, and the para aduma, its potion, which comes to get rid of that tuma, works as an atonement for the sin that symbolizes the downgrading of the status of the body from mere receptacle, or even better, to cooperator, if that's a word, cooperator with the neshama, to one that worked against the neshama. You're listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Chukat. I neglected to mention before that it is the 3rd of Tammuz, and I'd like to speak a little bit about that later. 3rd of Tammuz, 5766, the 29th of June, 06, Thursday, first broadcast. And if you're listening at some subsequent date, it still was recorded on Thursday. In fact, to put us into the Shabbat mood, here is a track from an album by Noam Productions called Lema'ancha. That's the name of the album. The track is Yom Shabbaton, or Yom Shabboson, which is one of the Zmirot for Shabbat Day. Enjoy! That was Yona Katz singing Yom Shabbaton from the album Lama'ancha by Noam Productions. We were talking, I was giving my theory as to how to connect in a stronger way the Pora Aduma business with Chet HaEgel. And just to sum it up, I believe that Chet HaEgel defined the human failing which leads to sin, and therefore it created or is the original cause of the status of ritual impurity of a dead body, that which is now without its soul. And it is almost like a admonition by God saying, you didn't treat your neshama properly. People don't treat their neshamot properly. This, then, is the status of the dead body. Another possible scenario, which would also explain it in a very significant way, is that it's not that death, which is the parting of the soul from the body, creates the tumah in the dead body. It's the chet ha'egel which created or caused death to occur in general. In other words, this might get a little fanciful, but picture God's original plan, so to speak, to create human beings that would be the internal inhabitor of earth. And yet human beings at that first juncture showed that living forever or even a very, very long time does not allow proper control of human behavior, and therefore death came to the world, and therefore shortening of time came to the world, of one's time in the world. When it came to the Jewish people, when it came to the Sinai revelation, we could say that God said, I'm going to try this again. I'm going to try it not with the total human population, but I will try it with an important subset of human beings known as Am Yisrael, the Jewish people. And the relationship between God and the Jewish people through the giving of the Torah at Sinai had the potential of giving us a different way of life, so to speak, from regular human beings, if you want to say that, which might have included not sinning and therefore not dying. But death became, again, a part of human and Jewish human existence by virtue of what symbolizes communal sin, the sin of the golden calf. So it's the golden calf that actually created death, sort of. I hope that's sort of getting across, even though I don't know how to say it well. And therefore, that which removes the ritual impurity of death, from contact with death, is an atonement for Chet HaEgel. Personally, I like the first explanation better. On another aspect of Pora Aduma, on its status as chok, on its quintessential chok character, I wanted to also suggest the following. If we take mitzvot and divide them into chok and mishpat, which is one of the divisions, or dinim, mitzvot, all kind of other titles besides chok, we somehow get the impression that unlike the chukim, the enigmatic mitzvot, like Pora Aduma, like Shatnez, perhaps, like some aspects of kashrut or milk and meat, and other things as well, which we don't really fit into a way of thinking, then on the other category, in the other category, are mitzvot which are common sense mitzvot, mitzvot which good human beings would come up with even without being commanded. They would be part of the normal function of a culture and a society, and they make a lot of sense. Now, if we could apply that to a mitzvah, let's take as an example, not to muzzle an animal when it's working with food. Lo tachsom shor b'disho. A person having learnt about para aduma and then finishing with it and going on to another mitzvah could say, phew, that was hard, I didn't understand much of it, doesn't make much sense. But that's what the Torah says, you gotta do it. In fact, Rashi's comment on Zot Chukat HaTorah, this becomes our answer to the nations of the world who challenge us for doing weird things, things that are weird in their eyes. And they laugh at us, and they make fun of us. And our answer, with our head held high, proud to follow God's command, is that we don't have to understand, and we don't have to have common sense explanations for our commitment to God and to follow His Torah. Why do I do such a thing? Because the Torah says to do it. And this is an important component, that's the word I was looking for, an important component of a Jew's commitment, of the Na'aseh V'Nishma. We will do whatever you command. What do you mean? Then you will ask and learn and get the details. How could you make that commitment first? You can make that commitment if you're committing to following what God says and trusting in Him to tell you the right things to do. And therefore I don't need any explanation. It's the other kind of mitzvot that makes sense that we sometimes tend to say, well, I understand this and I'm committed to it because it makes a lot of sense. In the example that I just mentioned of Lo Tachsom Shor B'Disho, a person could say it would be cruel to the animal to muzzle it while it gets tempted to eat some of the food, and therefore a law that requires or forbids me to muzzle the animal when it's working with food is a good common sense law that every society should have. And those mitzvot, kind of mitzvot, tend to be very different in our attitude towards them of a chok. On the other hand, it's important to realize that every single mitzvah, including the most logical, the most obvious, have elements of chok in them in addition to their common sense, their logic, their reasonableness. Lo tachsom shor b'disho, maybe I shouldn't have used that as an example, is going to apply in technical situations where logic might break down. Now, I'm groping now in my mind to find an example, so I think I'll have to switch to another. Let's take a more universal kind of command, honor thy father and thy mother. Honor thy father and thy mother is reasonable in society, especially for a child who gets along with his parents, especially for a child whose parents have treated him well and taken care of him and provided for him for many years of his growth and development. What about a situation where a parent is abusive, where a parent has neglected the care of a child, where a parent has abandoned a child? Would we still see the logic and the reasonableness in Kabedet Avicha V'Etimecha? Possibly not. And yet, the Torah's command, Kabedet Avicha V'Etimecha, honor your father and your mother, is even in those situations where the logic does not bolster you to want to comply, and yet there are obligations. And you could complain by saying, but this can't be the reasonable mitzvah of honoring parents that I grew up with and I was taught. The answer is, this is God's command. And God's command includes those unusual situations, hopefully unusual, where, as an example from the Talmud, a great rabbi was delivering a lecture. His mother, who was not in her right mind, came and abused him and spit on him and ridiculed him, but he was duty-bound by the chok part of that mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em not to respond, or not to respond in a harsh way. What I'm suggesting is sort of redefining chok to mean a mitzvah that its chok component is so overpowering that I don't see readily any of the logic or common sense in the mitzvah, but I'm ready to do it. Whereas other mitzvot also have a chok component, but the chok component is joined by a reasonableness which appeals to a person who thinks about it and understands why he should do or should not do whatever the mitzvah commands or forbids. Let's have a listen to a track from Udi Ullman, number 3. The track is Od Yishama, a wedding song, in honor of my nephew Yosef and his Kala Bina, who will be married in Yirtz Hashem this coming Sunday evening. This is for them and for you. Yud Yishama from Udi Alman 3. I mentioned earlier that today is the 3rd of Tammuz. The 3rd of Tammuz is the date given by traditional sources for the unusual, unique, spectacular miracle recorded in the book of Yehoshua, where Yehoshua needed time to fight a battle, and he basically requested / demanded that the sun stop and that the moon stop and that time stand still so he could continue waging this war in daylight. Shemesh begivon dom v'yoreach be'emek ayalon. The Navi reports that God acquiesced to this request in a unique gesture towards human beings. God usually doesn't work like that. But what it does is raise the question of miracles. And for me, what it does is allow me to take a look at a sequence of events that deal with the sun and the moon, the miraculous as well as the natural. And a point that I've always tried to make is that nature is miracle, just of the more predictable, expected type, but no less a miracle. So if we start in thinking about this with Shemesh Begivon Dom, V'Yoreach Be'emek Ayalon, that was a one-shot deal where the sun and the moon stood still, whatever that means, then it reflects upon the fact that the sun and the moon don't stand still on a daily basis, and 24/7 they go about their appointed rounds. That is something that we acknowledge in many different ways, one of which is Kiddush Levana, tonight being the first opportunity, according to Minhag Yerushalayim, to say Kiddush Levana. But there we acknowledge that the sun and the moon seem to us to be thrilled and delighted to go about their appointed rounds without complaint and doing it faithfully. That very same moon and sun that God performed a miracle with for Yehoshua. The sun and the moon are part of our lives' miracles every single day. That they stood still once and that they don't stand still forever, that's all part of the miracle. And we are duty-bound to appreciate God for the flashy once-in-a-while things, as well as for the everyday, maybe even more. On another note, this is just came into my mind here. There's a time gap between Korach and Chukat of 38 years or so. Korach, actually back to Bamidbar, Naso, Bahalotcha, Shlach, and Korach. And if you go further back than that, you're also, I guess since Parshat Bo, when we came out of Israel, out of Egypt, the time frame of all of the Parshiot from the end of Bo through Korach covers less than 2 years from the Exodus out of Egypt. Parshat Chukat, the first part of Zot Chukat HaTorah BaParah Aduma, really does not belong to a specific time necessarily, although one suspects that too was early after the Exodus, because if it was of interest, let's say, to the people who were Tamei Meit, who came to complain they couldn't bring the first Korban Pesach, and they were commanded to bring Pesach Sheni, if they did, they had to be Tahor. In order to be Tahor, they needed Efer Porah Aduma, I guess. But let's say it either happened early, or it's an untimed command of the Torah. But then right after Chukat, after Parah Aduma, the next topic is the death of Miriam. And that occurred in the final year of wandering. And the episodes that follow this in the Sedra are all at the end of the wandering period. So there's, let's say, a 38-year gap, roughly, in the middle of Chukat. Certainly Korach belongs to the beginning of the wandering period, and Chukat mostly to the later, which raises one's speculation as to the gap within other sedras, or from one sedra to its neighbor. How many years? In other words, what two sedras? I don't have an answer yet. It's a project that I'll take on when I get some time. Emir Tzashem, Bali Neder. But it would be interesting to give a timeline of the whole Torah that's been done, with specific attention paid to the time gap between the end of one sedra and the beginning of the next. So you need information like, first of all, what span of years or days or whatever does a particular sedra cover? Second, the gap, if there is one, between the end of one sedra and the next, or the gaps within a sedra. In the past, I mentioned back in Lech Lecha that it tells us that Yishmael was born to Hagar, Avraham, and he was, Avraham, 86 years old at the time. The next pasuk says, and Avraham was 99 years. So there's a gap of 13 years from one pasuk to the next. But it's within the same sedra. It would be interesting to see where other gaps of time are, but certainly in Chukat, we find this gap. I don't have anything to say about it other than it's for your information. Also, you can say that the events of the intervening 38 years are very insignificant as far as we're concerned. We have much interest in the beginning period and a lot of interest in the very end of the wandering. In between, we have a travelogue coming up in Parshat Maaseh, but really no details as to what occurred during those years. Okay, one more tidbit about the Parsha, and I think we'll call it a show. And that's the last pasuk, the last verse. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael, they traveled. Vayachanu, and they camped ba'arvot Moav, in the plains of Moav, me'ever liarden Yerecho, on the east side of the Jordan River, sort of parallel to where Yericho, Jericho, is. What is noteworthy about this is they have arrived at their last place of encampment before crossing the Jordan River and entering Eretz Yisrael, which means they've gotten around a lot of places until the end of Chukat, Balak, Pinchas, Matot, Maaseh with its summary of the travels, but the parshiot themselves of Balak, Pinchas, Matot, and Maaseh are still in the same place, Arvot Moav. Devarim voet chanan ekev re'e shofetim ki teitze ki tavo nitzavim vayelech ha'azinu v'zot habracha. 11 parshiot in Devarim, 4 more in Bamidbar, is 15 parshiot. We are camped in the same place at the threshold of the land of Israel. What Yehoshua will do in the first post-Torah, post-Chumash book is bring the people across the Jordan into Eretz Yisrael. But here we are at the end of Chukat, poised at the threshold. On that note, I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov. I will put on one more piece of music for your listening enjoyment. After that, might be something else. People who listen to the end get something. And last week's, which I asked if anyone could identify, several people got it wrong. Others told me they didn't, it sounded familiar, but they didn't recognize it. What it was the theme from My Three Sons. What it'll be today, I don't know yet. But on this note, let me just say, L'Hishtameya. Okay, I got it. It's from an album by Mordechai Ben David called Efshar L'Takein. The track is a song called Nodelecha. It comes from the daily Shmona Esrei, the daily Amidah, the Modim Bracha. Of course, that's every day of the week, including Shabbat and Chagim. Nodelecha Nusaper Tehilatecha. We acknowledge you and we tell your praise al chayenu hamesurim biyadecha for the lives which are our lives which are given over into your hand. Va'al nishmotenu hapakudot lach, and to our souls that are given over to you as security. Va'al nisecha shebechol yom imanu, and for the miracles which you perform for us every day. Va'al niflo secha v'tova secha shebechol eight, etc. The miracles, the wonders which you are always and constantly doing. Mordechai ben David, nodelecha.
Oh,